For the past 7 years, David Mendez has served as Market Development Specialist at Shure Incorporated. In his role, he provides product trainings and educational seminars around the United States on a number of audio topics with the goal of training people on the proper use of wired microphones, wireless microphone systems, and personal monitor systems. He also routinely exhibits at various worship, music, and theatrical conferences, sharing product and application knowledge with attendees from all levels of experience. David is a graduate of Northwestern University, where he obtained a BS in electrical science and a bachelor's in music and classical guitar performance. Please welcome David Mendez.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back. I did the summer session. I've been a number of familiar faces. And back then, we covered, I know the topic that I covered was spectrum updates. Right, so we don't want to cover that again. There actually have been some developments of late, and we'll be happy to chat with you about what we know. That was really recent, as of a couple days ago. I know some of our folks came back from D.C. and had some new news for us. So if you want to chat about that, we can discuss that. We have a booth in the hall and a couple other Shure representatives. But the main focus for today, after talking to some of you all, was really to kind of go back to basics. This may be beginner for some, this may be too easy, this may be not anything you deal with, but we thought it would be valuable to kind of go through some good best practices for wireless, because as spectrum changes, as the spectrum crunch happens, more and more people are using wireless, it's going to be even more important to do things the right way and be aware of these best practices. So for some of you, I know I talked to a number of you at the summer session where you were wireless is something you deal with, but maybe not your forte or something that you deal with all the time. Hopefully, this will help this session. So before we get going, I always like to start with this Dilbert, little wisdom from Dilbert here. Well, you've probably seen this before, but it kind of encapsulates the crux of the problem is that oftentimes the people asking us to deal with wireless microphones don't really have any concept of what they're asking, because some things they're pretty bizarre. This applies to the spectrum crunch as well. The people that really started the spectrum reallocation and looking at more spectrum for broadband weren't really aware of what was going on. Same thing with the people trying to make requests about how to use it. So anyway, so when looking at range antennas, one of the key things we get calls on all the time, or when we're talking to people about wireless, is what is the range of a system, right? And the answer, to quote Pat Brown from Synodcon, is it depends. There is no set range, right? The companies specify 300 feet line of sight. That's a nominal, you should be able to get that with, a quarter wave, or with an omnidirectional passive antenna. But a lot of things affect that range. That's why there's really no good answer, right? It could be 500 feet, line of sight, unless, if you've happened to choose a frequency that's smack dab in the middle of a high power, DTV station, you'd be lucky to get 10 feet of range, right? It may still work, 5 feet from the receiver, but that's not really what you're supposed to do. Being indoors can help. Even if you happen to park yourself on top of a DTV station because of the shielding of the building. Depends on the building, though. So obviously, the answer is it depends. Visual representation is as such, right? If you have a carrier, say hypothetically 787-125, although I hope you don't have that frequency anymore, that one on my right, on your left, that would be good, clean frequency, right? Low noise floor, you're going to get really good range out of that, assuming everything else is set up properly. However, as the noise floor increases, right, that's going to affect your range. That signal peak is going to start dropping in strength the further you get from the receiver, right? It's the inverse square law. So every time you double the distance, you're going to lose about 3 dB. So logically, if the noise floor is higher, you're going to have less range. Some people will play with the squelch control within a receiver, and what the squelch circuit is meant to do is it's meant to mute the receiver, mute the system, if there's interference, too much noise, what have you. There are different types. Amplitude squelch, based on the RF signal strength. A lot of systems now have noise-sensitive squelch, or a tone key in particular, where if this tone key is not present, the receiver will clamp down and mute and not let that through. Noise-sensitive squelch can basically detect in the receiver, it detects the signature of, you know, a high-frequency sound that's associated with just RF noise, and it will mute if there's too much of that present. But usually on a lot of our receivers, you'll see the two blue lights, or it might be a different color. Those usually indicate there's tone key present. Some people play with that, you know, increasing it or decreasing it to improve the range. So if you decrease the squelch, you're going to allow more range, but at the expense of maybe a noisier signal. Right? In some environments with higher noise floors, it's necessary. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of muting of the system. I know some of our systems, we've put in a selectable squelch just for that purpose, if you're dealing with a really tough environment. In general, however, this can get you into trouble. So this is one of those things where if you're not sure about it, don't use it. Yeah, I know the pun. I'll probably say that a lot, so not if you're not sure. So antenna types, this is key. So one of the more basic ones is omnidirectional, usually referred to as WIP antennas. Those take on a few different form factors. There's the quarter wave guys, all the way to your left on the top. Those are omnidirectional, passive. They're not terribly useful unless they're mounted to the receiver, to the front of the chassis. These are not for remote mount application. For any kind of remote mount application, you need to go with at least a half wavelength, usually about a foot, maybe slightly under a foot long or longer. If you're using a half wave, you can pull those off the back of the receiver, off the front panel, mount them on a mic stand or clamp it to something and get better range via height. You can do that, but not the quarter waves. Okay. The other type, directional. You've seen these before, probably. The paddle, the shark fin, or even the helical. These are meant for longer range applications. These are not meant for, you know, 30 feet, 40 feet, which we see a lot of people do. They're really, you know, 100 feet, 150 or more. We actually say you should be able, with good line of sight, you should be able to get well over 300 feet with a pair of paddles on your receiver. The problem that you can run into using a paddle in close range is overloading the receivers. If you overload the receiver, it's going to result in additional noise, some distortion, possible dropouts, which I have an interesting graphic about too much gain. Okay. With the quarter wave, as you see, quarter wave omnis need a ground plane. Right? That's why they must be attached to the ground plane. Here with the half-wave dipole, that's why you don't need the ground plane. The other half of the dipole kind of serves as the ground plane. So clearly, we see this a lot, actually. It's hard to see, but there's your antennas. We actually had to open the back of the rack to take this photo. So this is going to be a problem. They are clearly mounted to the receiver, which is good. However, they're not mounted to the front, which is bad. I'll periodically be showing some of these examples here. So looking at an omnidirectional, it's important to note, and this particular one is our wideband omni model. We have one that goes 470 to 1100 megahertz. If the antenna was pointing out of the screen, so this way, you get the nice spherical pickup, right? Omnidirectional. However, it's important to note if the antenna is lined up as it is over there, right? So this pole, you notice that there's a null top and bottom. So it's more of a donut kind of shape. This is why, looking at this image, the other thing that's interesting to note here is we get this call a lot. We always say, make sure you point the antennas at the, you know, where the transmitters are, right? Pointing them does not mean this way. Because of that null, right? So by pointing the top of the antenna at where the transmitters are, you're actually potentially losing about 9, 10 dB or so. Indoors, because signals are bouncing around, it depends on the room, but because of reflections, indoors it may not make as big of a difference, but certainly outdoors where you don't benefit as much from reflection, that can be a problem. Again, as we go through a lot of these best practices, each individual thing is not necessarily going to break the situation, right? It's not necessarily fatal. However, it could be the last thing of a series of things that are maybe not done right, which caused the whole thing to go down. So as I present these problems, it's not sort of just because I fix this, it's not necessarily going to fix everything. These are just things to try for troubleshooting. But certainly when we mean pointing half waves, we mean the plane of the antenna facing where the transmitters are. For directional antennas, the paddles, these are about 120 or so degree pickup window vertically. They actually have slightly less of a window horizontally. So if you do have these mounted up high, it is important, like, you know, if it's a fixed location at a stadium or studio or something like that, where you do have them up pretty high, you will actually need to aim the paddles to some extent, a little more than you think, vertically. The helicals are an even narrower pickup. A helical antenna, which we distribute the one made by Professional Wireless, this is a very narrow, something like 60 degree beam, used for, you know, well over 500 feet. And these are the ones employed at stadiums that are mounted, you know, way up where the audio booth is, which is generally an inconvenient spot. But the helicals can help, you know, really reduce the ambient RF pickup and kind of focus on the field. Also perfect for parade routes as well. If you really have a long throw down one side, helical antennas can be good for that as well. So there you can see the polar patterns, right? So the thicker line here would be sort of this direction. The dotted line would be trying to shoot at, you know, the top or bottom. So there's a lot less pickup consistency, top and bottom, just like the null point of the Omni. It's important to note that there's about 5 to 7 dBi forward gain. The dBi, if you're not familiar with that, that's 5 to 7 dB with respect to a theoretically perfect omnidirectional antenna, which doesn't really exist, but that's still the metric that gets used. So in terms of gain when compared to an actual real Omni, that's probably more like 4 to 5, probably 5 dB average. A lot of these antennas have amps on the back of them, which provide additional gain, but that gain is different. That gain is meant for passing signal back through the antenna cable, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, this shouldn't be new. I'll skip over this. Important thing to note, the reason we put this in here is that the component of the EM wave that we're concerned with for wireless mics is the electrical part, which just so happens to be polarized. If this was a half-wave antenna, an Omni, polarized in the orientation of that antenna. So when I talk about antenna orientation, that's why we're focused on, in line with the antenna, it's the electric field. So a common thing with microphones, with waves in general, is multipath. This is something you're going to deal with for in-ear monitors, for wireless mics. As a signal travels outward from the transmitter, it's going to bounce off metal, clearly. So what we end up having is kind of the analog of phasing with, you know, like comb filtering for audio. This is kind of like comb filtering in a lot of ways for RF. So multipath interference is not interference from another signal. It's actually the direct wave and the reflected wave canceling each other out. Okay. older systems, and actually some current in-ear monitor systems, are non-diversity systems. The challenge there being that the receiver originally only had one antenna, which means that it was possible in certain parts of the venue for there to be multipath dropouts. Diversity, which is now very common in wireless mic receivers, and now starting to appear in in-ear monitor receivers as well, is meant to get rid of that, which the idea being that you've got now two antennas with a scheme to compare either the signal on both or the audio quality on both. In some cases, there's actually two different receiver sections that are compared and then fed to the one channel. The idea being that if you get the antennas for that wireless mic channel a reasonable distance apart, you can basically bring the probability of a dropout due to multipath down to almost zero. So the question is, what is that reasonable distance apart? How should I really be mounting these antennas? The key placement is at least a quarter wavelength. So again, that quarter wave antenna, those rubber ducky antennas you've probably seen, probably about 4 inches or so, that's probably the minimum spacing that you want. As you increase that spacing, you improve the diversity up to a point. Once you get to about a wavelength, just slightly over, which a general rule of thumb for that is probably about 1 19-inch RACU is sufficient spacing for diversity. Right, so once you get to that spacing, that's the best you're going to do as far as, you know, dealing with the signal's multipath interference. Beyond that, you don't necessarily improve diversity, but it might be useful to separate the antennas further for coverage, right? But as far as this diversity issue, if you're wondering, you know, I have to mount these things using one mount or some kind of special apparatus, how far do I need to get them? At least a quarter wavelength, again, 4 inches or so. And once you get it to about, you know, a foot and a half, that's very good. The other thing is orienting the antennas. We mentioned the electrical part of the fields coming out basically in the same orientation as the body pack whip. So how would you, ideally you want the receiver antenna to be oriented the same way, right, to get maximum signal transfer. That's not always easy to predict, especially because the signal could be bouncing around. Or if somebody's using a handheld, you know, it's impossible to predict. They're going to be moving around. So what we do, well, that's why we recommend the 45 degree or 90 degrees from each other sort of traditional rabbit ear placement, is that if one antenna is placed this way, that's great for one situation. If I place the other one like this, I basically have, you know, half the diversity working for this polarization and half the diversity working for this polarization. So at worst, if I receive a signal that's, you know, 45 or more degrees off, the diversity can handle that, right? So I've kind of split the difference by having one that's vertical and one horizontal. But it really doesn't matter how those are oriented, right? So I can put them 45 degrees off vertical. As long as the antennas are 90 degrees away from each other or off from each other, that's a good way to kind of handle that situation too. So you'll see this sometimes where people will get boom stands and hang paddles on using this orientation, or obviously you'll see this on racks where people just sort of, it's almost habit, but this is why that works. It's because of diversity receivers and multipath. Another thing is altitude is your friend. We run into this a lot, particularly actually at churches in the sound booth, where you have the rack. They do a good job of, you know, everyone gets a good job of getting the antennas out on the front, but either the antenna distribution box is racked at the bottom, and that's where the antennas go, or the rack is just kind of sitting on the bottom or towards the bottom of the rack, and the antennas are on the front, but they're still sort of low to the ground. This could happen in a studio, this could happen at a parade route, this could happen anywhere, where during a rehearsal or test or what have you, everything works fine because there's not as many people around. but the antennas are somewhere in that sort of 6 foot or lower window. But the instant you start getting people around, we're really good, exceptionally good at blocking RF, if you weren't aware. So getting the antenna up higher is going to help with dealing with body absorption. It's also just going to help in terms of, you know, the way that the transmitter is radiating out. This will be a good spot for you to sort of see the area. But mostly this is for getting a good reception point above people. To prove this point, there's a study done that, you know, basically mount a body pack on a human. There's your receiver up at the top. And as you spin either one, spin the person, spin the receiver, you can see just how much body absorption actually does to a signal. Right? In this situation up here where the transmitter has to transmit through the person, you know, 15 or 20 dB, as much as. That's huge. You know, so that's why this is a real key argument right there for body absorption. A lot of cases, that's what makes the case for putting a transmitter higher on a person, front pocket, you know, or locating receivers in a location, which is to the side or the back, just so the transmitter doesn't actually have to shoot through the person. Here's another one, and this is key. If you're using comms or in-ear monitors, especially something that's higher power that's transmitting, and you're also using wireless microphones, you can rack them together, that's fine, the rack units, but it's especially crucial that you separate the antennas, the transmit and the receive antennas, at least 8 feet, probably at least 10 feet apart. Because a lot of these transmit devices, IEM and comms, are, you know, most of them were 100 milliwatt fixed. Some of the newer systems you can actually select lower than 100 milliwatt. I know our PSM 900 and 1000 systems, you can drop from 100 to 50 and even to 10 milliwatt, depending on the range that you need. But the range that you guys typically need is probably going to be longer. So a lot of times those get set to at least 50, probably 100. That's a pretty high power signal as far as wireless microphones are concerned. And if you have antennas a couple feet apart, you're going to saturate those receivers. And what's going to happen is your overall wireless mic range is going to drop way down, or worse. You're going to have noise, distortion in the system. It's just not going to operate well. You're going to overload things. So try to get transmit IEM or comm antennas at least 10 feet, if not more, away from your wireless mic antennas. Like I said, the rack can live together. They can be racked up in one rack, but just pull half waves off, separate them out on mic stands or clamp somewhere. Okay, here's a key thing. So this right here, I don't know if you can see the grating, this is going to be a problem. We'll talk about why. This location, I think it was a school, they did a really good job of building this structure to mount their antennas 45, you know, degrees off of vertical, so 90 degrees apart. They needed to protect the antennas from basketballs or whatever object was going to be thrown around that day. So they constructed this nice metal cage, dropped it over top of the antennas, and then, of course, we get the phone call. We just bought all this stuff and spent hundreds and thousands of dollars, you know, on this system. Hundreds of dollars on the antenna rig and thousands of dollars on the system. We're only getting 40 feet of range. And we actually said, that's pretty good. It's a metal grate. So what's happening is all the signals trying to get in, it's bouncing off, right? They would have been better to get just, you know, the range was probably 50, 60 feet, maybe. They would have been better to put just half-wave antennas on top of that cage and be done with it. But we certainly appreciate them, you know, buying the paddles. And you probably know this already, but again, RF waves, the EM wave, if it sees a metal obstacle and the wavelength is smaller than an obstacle, the wave will be reflected completely, right? If the object is small relative to the wavelength, it's just going to go through, you know? So that example before, The problem is with openings, right? But if the openings had been large enough in that cage, they might have been okay. The problem was the openings were probably 3 inches by 3 inches maybe or so, maybe even smaller than that. So to the waveform trying to get through, it looked like a solid metal box was enclosing those antennas, right? This is, again, the microwave example, right? It's the reason you can see your food cooking without getting cooked yourself. So keep basic rule of thumb is if you have antennas, try to keep them as clear from metal as you can. Be it a portable receiver. You know, sometimes people forget about the bag receivers and things like that. If you're using those, just keep very conscious of what is kind of around those receivers because it can affect reception. So as far as remoting antennas, if you need to do that, again, half-wave omni only, or the wideband directionals. Line of sight, diversity separation. This is really a conversation about gain. So we run into a lot of folks that like to use lots of gain, or they don't even necessarily realize that they bought an active antenna, and it was already set to a nominal gain level, and just kind of left it alone. We used to ship our active paddles at 10 dB. We learned, because it was not the easiest thing in the world to unscrew the cap and get in there. So now they actually ship at 3 dB. What you're really shooting for with antenna gain as far as the amplifiers in line or as part of the paddle is sort of a plus or minus 5 dB. You don't want to really go much more than 5 dB of gain or much, you know, more than 5 dB of loss with whatever you're doing. Cable, inline amps, all that cascading, all that kind of stuff. So plus or minus 5 dB. And of course, cable loss is going to be totally dependent on the type. You guys probably use all manner of cable. Lower loss is best. In fact, we usually recommend, the point of this slide is we usually recommend, rather than going with an active paddle to compensate for the cable loss, a lot of times people have had much better success using a passive paddle antenna, and those do exist. We do sell those largely for our in-ear monitor systems, but they can be great mic receiver antennas. So it's a passive paddle. It still has the forward gain as far as picking up less ambient RF and just by virtue of the pattern, but there's no amp on the back of it. And what you do to compensate for the lack of amp is just use higher quality cable. You know, some of the RG8, or there's plenty of Belkin, or rather, not Belkin, we were talking about that earlier, Belden, you know, really moosey kind of stuff. But I would say at least the RG213, but slightly better, LMR 400, things like that, with a passive paddle would be a good way to go, or a helical of that sort, or even a half wave. But using gain can get you into trouble. If you do have to use it, because you're just stuck with, here's the antenna cable I have, and I need to make this work, we do have inline amps, right? These are set to, our current ones have +3 or +10. Just be conscious of how much cable loss you have when you use that. Those are better to put at the antenna side rather than closer to the receiver. That's the way they were intended. So here's a little graphic I made with our, we have a new wideband scanner called a Spectrum Manager. It allows us also with the Workbench, Wireless Workbench 6 software that we have to do overlays. So our newest paddle can select -6, 0, +6, and +12. So here's an overlay of what happens going from a 0 dB setting, which would be the same as the passive paddle with no amp, to +6 and +12. I don't know, can you guys see that well? Look at the huge difference. You see, it makes it somewhat of a difference going to +6. That's probably an okay setting, but look at all the noise that you get going to +12 dB with that amp. That can dramatically affect your coordination results if you're trying to do a coordination for other people. It can dramatically affect the performance of the mics using too much gain. That's the other reason with this particular paddle antenna, and actually a lot of our receivers, they've started to they've started to have included a RF overload light. So at the top of the RF meters, you'll see the tone key lights, but you'll also see a red LED with OL or something of that nature next to it. If those are lit, that's a good indication that you need to back off the gain a little bit. And that can be done either with the gain settings inline amps, paddle amps and all that, or that could be indication that you're using too much power on the transmit side as well. So another thing to note is no requirement for symmetry. So a lot of people think just because I've got a paddle on one side, I need a paddle on the other. I need these things to balance out. As long as the gain is basically balanced out on each side, so you're not, you know, have huge amounts of loss on one side versus the other, you could do a paddle on one side and an Omni on the other. You know, that's actually a common parade route thing where you maybe need a longer throw down one side, but you need to pick somebody coming in a corner this way. That can be a useful thing to do, is a paddle and an Omni, depending on what you need there. Antenna distribution, okay, and placement. So again, when you're placing these things, antenna distribution is important. It's worth doing. One, it's just kind of a hassle to deal with 4, 5, 6 pairs of antennas, especially if you're installing in a studio. This should be just not even a thought. You should just do this. But keep in mind that having half-wave antennas, it's okay to have them mounted perpendicular to the surface, but having a parallel metal surface right next to the antenna can sort of deform the polar pattern and really sort of mess with your range. That also includes other antennas as well, right? These are also parallel metal structures. So having the antenna farm not only is unwieldy as far as dealing with remote mounting antennas, but it can also degrade the polar pattern of each one and sort of mess with your range. That's one of the reasons antenna distribution is important. So if you're just combining two receivers, if it's maybe a portable bag you're taking out in the field or whatever, you can do passive splitting, that's fine. A number of companies have a simple T passive splitter. Splitting two receivers is okay, but you get about 3 dB of insertion loss with a passive split. So if you split again, you're getting into that range of maybe too much loss that can affect your system. For anything more than 2, we generally recommend active splitting or using RF cascade if it's built in. So here's the passive split. Easy. Active distro box, so again, antenna signals come in to A and B, and then signals fed down. If you're trying to do more than one distro's worth of product, you can actively kind of cascade to a second antenna distro, but we don't recommend going to a third active unit below that. So if you're going to go further than this, this is kind of one of the recommended ways, right? So you've got sort of a master-slave unit. You've got the master unit and then the 4 rows. But a lot of newer systems, UHFR has this, I think some of the Sennheiser system, a bunch of them are including RF cascade. Generally, these are active cascades, so there is some makeup gain. So the limitation isn't so much loss through the cascade, it's actually noise floor coming up a little bit, right? So each system by each manufacturer will have a different spec as far as what you can do with the cascade, so be aware of that. I can just, off the top of my head, for example, our UHFR system has cascade now, and that one we recommend no more than 10 chassis. So that could be, if you're using dual receivers, that could be up to 20 channels cascaded, which is great because most things now you're going to be able to do with one active antenna distro box, right? Because one of your pairs can handle 20 channels in the distro box. The next, pair 2 can then be 20 more. So most things are going to be just one distro, and you can use cascade that way. Our ULX digital system, which is a brand new thing, that one has a quad receiver that has a cascade port, but that one, we only allow you to cascade to a second, maybe third chassis. So that's up to 8 or 12 channels there, because there's a lot of internal distribution going on with a quad receiver already. But this is a very handy thing that's starting to populate more of the high-end systems. There's a picture of UR. It's also important to note, aside from the sort of noise floor gradually creeping up and that being the limitation of how many you can cascade, it is an active cascade. So it is band limited. So that's one possible limitation of cascading, is that if a multi-band system, you know, one tunes from 470 to 530 megahertz, and the other tunes from 638 up, you can't cascade those. The other thing is that if you're worried about power going out or anyone possibly hitting switches or unplugging something, if you lose power on a unit in the middle, you lose RF all the way down below that, because it's an active cascade. So it's a very convenient thing, but just be careful, because pretty much all the cascade I know of out in the market is active. It's band limited, and you need to be careful about locking out power switches and making sure that no one's going to be constantly back there near power cables, possibly pulling things loose, because you might lose RF. So here's a kind of a fun one. Large antenna coverage, if you're doing a studio, this can be done. Just requires an elaborate network of passive splits and makeup gain. Most of our receivers have, on the receiver box, it'll tell you the current and the voltage for the DC that's going to go back out through the antenna port that will power the inline amps. Because that's how the amp on the paddle and the inline amps gets its power, is from the antenna distro or the receiver ports. With most of our stuff, you can power two. The idea being, you know, one, the amp on the paddle and the inline amp, or just two inline amps. If you need to do more than that, you're going to have to wire in, get a bias T, and add that in. That's going to supply additional power onto the line for additional amps. That can be done. We just need to be aware. And again, different receivers can power different amounts of these. This was kind of a fun, this was a casino. It's kind of humorous. You guys know what's on the receiving end of this thing? One ULX receiver. They probably spent, because it's the plenum rated, you know, real thick antenna cable, they probably spent about five times or more on the money than the wireless mic system on the antenna rig just to feed it back, but that was pretty amazing. So, coordination. Okay, this is good. This is the part that's getting trickier. Main UHF interference sources, as you know, over-the-air TV signals. Of course, you need to watch out for the lower power. This is something that a lot of our users forget. You guys, of course, are intimately familiar with this. And this is going to vary a lot depending on where you're at. I've taken scans all over Chicago and superimposed them, and it's fascinating, actually. I've done this in LA too. LA is particularly fascinating, just how much the terrain affects that, right? We recently had an issue where some of our lower tier stuff became, there's like a frequency band or two that somewhat became obsolete in certain parts of cities, because it's only an 18 megahertz tuning window. And if you're downtown, all the low power stuff is mounted, you know, at least for us in Chicago, on the Sears Tower and the Hancock Building. So it can wipe out a lot of spectrum that looks clear in most other parts of the city. That's why it's particularly important to do scans, right? You're never sure when, I got it again, you're going to find that, you know what, I know this low power TV station exists, but let's run a scan and see if I'm strapped for spectrum. You know, there's a lot of wireless going on and I need one or two extra channels. Maybe I can use this, maybe I can't. I don't know. I have to see. Another thing that's important, obviously the public safety channels. We have some provisions, certainly the software can be used to lock out the public safety channels in the markets so that you can't accidentally coordinate frequencies in there. Just running a scan isn't always going to do it. If you are not aware that there's a public safety channel, you should be, because I'm sure you guys know which of those 13 cities can rattle them off. But the scan may not catch that. When it's doing a scan to locate, if you have maybe like a bag portable receiver and you want to find one clear frequency, if you're using that band that goes down to 470, it's highly likely that you could hit scan. It will drop you in the middle of TV 14 because it's clear at that instant, and then you could have all kinds of problems. So it's important to use the software, block out the public safety channels, do your coordination, or run a series of scans, maybe, and then visually average them and see. If you notice a couple peaks coming up here and there, you know, pay attention. Public safety has gotten a lot of, it's very active. It's even more active now, I've noticed, with some gigs that we do. Of course, everybody else using wireless is another potential issue too, right? Theaters, be aware of what's around you. Theaters, churches, it doesn't matter if the system should be off, sometimes it's left on. You know, particularly in your monitor systems, a lot of people will just, you know, they'll leave those things camped. They'll camp on channels. You should find them with the scan, but you never know. Somebody could be running tests and playing around and be turning things on and off. Let's point this out too. So the reason I put these here is, I don't know if you can see these red bars. There's one here. Those are part of our zip code database in our software, the Wireless Workbench 6. So we tend to list only the major high power TV channels. Otherwise, if we listed everything, we would get calls all the time with people saying we can't find any frequencies, right? So all the majors are here, but it's important to note, again, that it's not going to find everything, and things have moved. So update any zip code listing that you have. Pay attention to your scan, because it may not, the zip code listing may not have that there. And the other thing to note is, you guys all know what that is, right? Uh-huh. I thought those were supposed to be gone. Yeah. Well, clearly, there's a number of those still around. I think in Chicago still has 3, 23, 34, and 41. And you could play the old trick if you really needed to, but you're not supposed to. But it can get people into trouble. I know a lot of people will try to place comms in there, and that's a tricky proposition. We've had people try it, and then they call us and say, we're having issues with our wireless at large. We think it's our stuff, and then we end up troubleshooting the comms because they put it here. Or again, this down here, this is 14 and 15. You can see what I was able to catch on my Spectrum Manager scan there. 14 was particularly active, 15 not as much, but it might be. It's just in that particular snapshot, I couldn't see it. So of course, other interference sources. You've got IEM, we talked about this already. Studio transmitter link, this only comes at, we do actually have, how many, show of hands, how many people here use wireless in the 944 to 952 band? Okay, I figured. Good. That's this. This is the one time where I can say that's probably okay because you have a license. But just be aware that that's potentially, I've seen some areas where that's an issue. Let's skip through. So compatibility issues. If you're just adding a second system, you really need to be conscious of just what is the channel-to-channel spacing of the system, right? Adding a second system is not hard. You just, as depends on the wireless system, whether you can just move it over 400K, or if it's not that great of stuff, it could be a meg and a half or more, but you need at least that minimum spacing. That has to do with the general selectivity of the wireless, the IF filter. And that's been getting better and better, and that's one of the keys moving forward with wireless mics is trying to use spectrum more efficiently, getting this channel-to-channel spacing narrower, right? And also dialing down the intermods on the transmit side of things. And our newest system, which you can see in the booth, is a ULX digital system, actually has a mode in it. The standard mode can do as many as 17 transmitters in one open TV channel. There's a high-density mode, which changes the the modulation scheme. It also changes the filtering. It's a transmitter and receive change, but it allows you to do up to 47 transmitters in 6 megahertz at a reduced range. But that's going to be one of the keys, is really trying to fit more and more together. As far as transmitters go, you're probably familiar with this, but transmitters will produce additional intermod products. As you add second and third, you start getting these additional signals appearing. And there's just a screenshot example we have of, you know, 8 transmitters on and what that does to your noise floor in general. So this brings up the importance of using software to coordinate or a frequency coordinator, really listening to them, depending on what the event is. And it also really underscores the importance of paying attention to certain conventions. So if, and this is not useful all the time, but in the case of you're only concerned with our wireless or one particular SKU, the group and channel scheme is groups of compatible frequencies. So if it's just UHFR or Sennheiser, 5K, and you're just working with that, the idea was that you could set them all to that group, and then all the frequencies within that group are compatible doing a scan. However, if you use anything else, it can break that, right? So this scheme is only really useful if you're using that one thing. That's why software programs and compatibility tools are really key. So currently, we've got 2 versions of this software. The older version, how many people here have used Wireless Workbench 5? 1, 2. How about 6? Anyone seen that? Okay, I highly encourage, if you haven't, they're both free software, so it's the right price. You can go onto the Shure site, download. The only thing we ask with 6 is that you create a login, user ID. You'll get an email asking you to confirm that the email is yours, and then you'll have access to this forum, which not only gives you access to download the latest version of Workbench 6, but you can check in with the forum and see what are the frequently asked questions. You can pose questions. And it's technically, the software is still beta, not because it's not stable, but only because we are actively working on feature sets. So we are taking user feedback for requests. So if you hop on the forum and say, hey, I'd like to be able to do XYZ, I noticed the software doesn't do that. Can we do that? This is crucial. You can chime in and let us know. You can see what other people are doing. Right now, Workbench, actually it's 6.5, came out the other day. UHFR receivers, ULXD, PSM-1000 in-ear transmitters, and the Axient system all are compatible with this software. And you can use those systems to scan their range. The key component being the Spectrum Manager, which is a 470 to 952 megahertz wideband RF scanner with onboard frequency calculator and backup frequency monitoring. So this can be a device that you can use to scan the entire environment beyond what your mics may do. It can be useful for coordinating other things and also coordinating additional backup frequencies which can be stored in there. Even if it's not this Axient system. If you're using Electro, for instance, you can use a Spectrum Manager to scan your environment, coordinate your Electro, ask for a couple additional backup frequencies, and the Spectrum Manager will sit on those backup frequencies and rank them and check their real-time signal level and let you know the health of those backups. So if you have an issue, obviously you'll have to intervene manually, but you'll be able to visually look at that backup and tell whether it's good at that moment. So more tools like this are also going to be, aside from spectral efficiency and lower intermod performance in the transmitters, more technology and more tools like that with your wireless are going to be helpful as things get more complicated. Of course, the final bit here, how many folks here use the IAS software? You use everything, Carl. Just keep your hand up. So this is currently in the market. This does cost, how much is a license? There's 2 versions, right, Carl?
I have no idea because I talked to the program.
Yeah. I think it's in the 100 range, a couple hundred though. It depends on, there's a trial for free, and then I think there's a regular, and then there's a pro version. Those vary in price. That software also does a number of the things that 6.4, 6.5 does, but you can do things like uncheck the order of intermods. So there's a lot of, some things you can do with the IAS software that allow you to very quickly change your coordination based on some factors, whereas the Shure software, you can change some of those things, but you have to, currently have to go back into the profiles of the system and make those changes, which is a little more time consuming. But these are just a lot of tools that you can utilize. Of course, WinRadio, is a very lower cost scanner that can be useful. It's $800-900, and then various other analyzers. So these are just some online tools. You'll be able to get this presentation, so if you want to check these, there's just things on our website that can help. Remote antenna tool, put in the distance between the antenna and the receiver, feeder meters, and then give it the antenna type, and it's just a kind of a primer for, you know, a good starting place. Here's what you'll maybe need to do to be okay. Additional articles, this is just stuff, resources that we have online. So I think I'm out of time here, but we started early, so I think we're good. Time for questions, or are we out? Okay. Any? Carl. Oh, there's a mic. There's a mic coming. A wireless mic. That'd be pretty funny if we had a really long wired 58 that we dragged around at the wireless presentation.
A question and a comment here. Is WinRadio supported on all the versions of Wireless Workbench or just version 5?
Okay, so currently WinRadio is only supported, and those two models, actually I think only one of those is currently, I think that's the one that they currently still make, the G33. That's only supported on Workbench 5. Currently Workbench 6, only the Shure networked devices. Okay. That may change, though. Now, we've gotten several requests already, but if you want to throw that request into the forum, you can. But there's already a number of requests logged for TTI and WinRadio compatibility with with Workbench 6. TTI with regard to probably just CSV file imports. So if you have a frequency list, you can have a CSV file and just import it. So that's something we're logging.
The second is a comment here on using a spectrum analyzer for doing coordination. Just because you see nothing there, especially down in the lower TV 14 mm-hmm. and 15, just because you see nothing there doesn't mean that those frequencies are clear, because the public safety folks tend to put voting receivers at especially right. large venues. A voting receiver will not see anything from a voting receiver. Yeah. So you put a wireless mic in that frequency band, and the cops will make your life miserable.
Yeah, that's a good point. I thought I had made mention of that, but in the Spectrum Manager, there's a way of blocking those out. In the software, there's a way of blocking out public safety. Another useful thing in some of the receivers, particularly the UHFR, is custom groups. So what we urge you to do, if you're using wireless that tunes down to 470 to 506 range, is to create some custom groups. A lot of rental houses will actually do this by default, and they will create custom groups that ignore the frequencies in their area. So if LA, LA, the like VER in LA, maybe, I know some of the guys will go in and create custom groups that don't allow people to get into the public safety channels. I know Chicago, some of the Chicago companies will do that and not allow 14 and 15 to happen. But out of the box, that's not the case. So yeah, that's the key thing, is using a spectrum analyzer, spectrum scanner, or just a scan on the receiver, you may not catch that. So thanks. Anything else?
Yeah, flashing back to your diagram about the antennas and having a half-wave antenna in front of a vertical metal plane, that mm-hmm. being a bad situation, is that improved by angling the antenna in the vertical plane, if you tip it away from the metal plate behind it, does that help things out? And if that metal plate maybe is other equipment in a rack, would leaving a space in between each 1U unit, leaving an air gap, make an effect?
Pulling it out a little bit may help with that regard, but then also depends on where you're at. I mean, I would say my suggestion would simply just be take it off the front of the rack or get it towards the top so it's in free space. Would make the most difference.
I have a question. Does any of your receivers have Ethernet connections for either IP codec output or remote control?
We have, so the UHFR, ULXD, and Axient systems, the wireless mics, have Ethernet jacks. They're AMX Crestron compatible, so there's source code on the FAQ for AMX Crestron. That's also used for the wireless workbench connectivity, largely version 6, of course. As far as other information that's spit out along that, I'm not completely certain, you know, what that gives you beyond just AMX Crestron and workbench compatibility. What you were looking for, which IP? Ah, so you're looking for like a digital audio out?
Right.
Yeah, so the only system, so UHFR does not. UHFR, the Ethernet jack is simply for control. ULXD has Dante built into it. If you get a dual and a quad receiver, Dante's built in. And Axient, the Ethernet jack is only for control, but the Axient receivers have AES3 as far as digital audio goes. Clear as mud.
Dave, I wonder, I know that Kelly Williams will probably cover part of this on Thursday when he talks about the spectrum rules or the proposal that's just been released by the FCC. But for those of you that were at our summer conference, we had some great sessions on spectrum. Dave gave one and I gave another one, how to do the database, how to protect yourself and your wireless mics. Some of that's going to change, and I know a lot of you people in here will be not with us on Thursday when we discuss this, but you should pay attention to what's going to happen in the spectrum auction process. Particularly, the one thing I can recall that put up a red flag was they were going to reserve 2 television channels per market to operate wireless microphones on. They're now proposing to not do that. So they're going to take those 2 those 2 TV channels per market out of the rules, and that will have an impact, especially on some of the larger markets where it's really, really congested. So again, for those of you folks that won't be with us on Thursday when we discuss this a little more in detail, you should be paying attention for your wireless mic spectrum and how the television TV spectrum auctions are going to affect that. And it was just released a week and a half ago.
Yeah, our guys just came back a couple days ago. I have a graphic in my booth which illustrates the proposal. Again, this is just a proposed idea. There's some challenges to having this happen, especially on the timetable that they want. It's a very aggressive timetable. I think they mentioned something to the effect of wanting to conduct the auction by 2014, or in 2014, which... given everything that has to happen as far as finding out who's okay with sharing in the revenue, who's willing to, you know, get rid of their, you know, move or surrender their allocation in that timetable, I don't know if I see that actually happening, but that's their proposal. It's just what it is. It's just an idea. It's not...
It's a proposal for... And they want comments on it now, obviously, as the normal... proposal for rulemaking happens, but it is in there, and that's what they're proposing, one of the many things.
Yeah. So we're still reading it and kind of fleshing out at least our posting, how we want to proceed, but we always post this stuff on our site. So if you look at our press site, there's a whole section on white spaces, and every, you know, press releases go there, any updates to what's going on, that can be found on our site, as well as obviously the FCC and NAB sites and such. But
okay, thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.